I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound Archive writing .upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Julia Block, teacher, brilliant co-convener of online poetry communities, associate director of this very Kelly Writer's House, co-teacher with me of ModPo, a free open convening site for discussions of poetry each autumn for some 40,000 people each time. Fabulously talented editor and widely published poet, author of Post-Psychiatric Sonnets and a series of letters to Kelly Clarkson, and who, along with Michael Hennessy, is editor of Jacket 2 magazine. And by Patty McCarthy, author of L&O from Little Red Leaves and Book of Hours and Table Alphabetical of Hard Words, among other works, whose writing has appeared in many journals, including Colorado Review, Ducey, Fanzine, Ixnay Reader, Lungful, the Poetry Project Newsletter, and The Tangent, who has taught literature and creative writing at Queens College, Loyola University, Maryland, and Towson University, who lives in Philadelphia and currently teaches at Temple University. And by Stephen Radcliffe, Boston-born, Bolinas-residing poet, publisher of Avenue B Press, for many years director of the creative writing program at Mills College, whose recent work has focused on the long, long poem written in consecutive days, very much rooted in the atmosphere, often literally the atmosphere of his place, Bolinas, California, and whose output has been amazing and prodigious, and is the poet I think of when we talk about the importance of rigorous commitment to documentation, observation, recording, routine, appropriation, and constraint, and whose series of almost alike mesmerizing Instagrams I stare at and scroll through every morning when I rise here on the East Coast. Steve, thank you so much for coming
thank
this
you,
distance.
And Patty, I enjoyed your posting about your run in Florida.
Yeah, I finally sort of got to a Bolinas-like place, but I envy you every day, and I'm so glad you get up. Do you get up earlier or later? You get up earlier. Yeah,
with
later.
With the light.
It's amazing. I recommend the Instagram. And Patty, it's nice to have you here on the third floor.
Thank you so much, Al.
And Julia, as ever.
Hey, Al.
It's great to see you.
You too.
And isn't it right that you attended Mills College?
I did, and I studied with Stephen Radcliffe. He was one of my amazing thesis advisors there. And
so this is a bit of a reunion.
Julia was writing the letters to Kelly Clarkson once a week coming into the workshop.
Kelly must have been a teenager at the time.
Boy, did that have everyone at the table, you know, riveted.
It did.
That's great.
It did.
Well,
yeah,
so nice to see that coming out as a book.
Support Julia in
she
the
was
creation
great.
Of that project.
She was great.
Well, today we four are here to discuss a poem by Joanne Kiger. It's been a long time, with the first line reading Notes from the Revolution. Readers can find the text of the poem in As Ever, Selected Poems, Penguin, 2002. It was written in the early or mid-1970s, and Penn Sound's recording of Kiger performing the poem is an audio segment extracted from the video recording of the March 28, 1978 episode of the TV show. Imagine that, today, a television show. Wasn't public access poetry a television show? So here now is Joanne Kiger performing It's Been a Long Time.
Been a long time. Notes from the Revolution. During the beat of this story, you may find many other beats. I mean a beat. I mean cantus. I mean firmus. I mean paper. I mean in the kingdom, which is coming, which is here in discovery. It is also Om Shri Maitreya. You don't go across my vibes, but with them, losing the pronoun. It is thy. It is thee. It is I. It is me. Machines are metal. They serve us. We take care of them. This is to me, and this is to you. You say you to me, and I say you to you. Some machines are very delicate. They are precise. They are not big metal stampers. She made enough poetry to keep her company. My vibes. You interrupted my vibes. The long shadows, the long shadows, the long shadows. My sweet little tone, my sweet little tone is my arm. On what only? The song that girls sang, the song that girls sang.
Well, we could go anywhere or start anywhere, but I'll just be conventional to start, which is to look at the beginning and ask any of you to say something about the beat in the first sentence and line. Patty, any thoughts about the beat? There's the beat of the story, and then there's beats, other beats we might find.
Right. I mean, I was thinking about the beats and the first line, the beat, other beats, a beat, and thinking about the language play, the next line with Cantus Firmus and this polyphonic composition. And so you have...
Can you explain those references?
The Cantus Firmus, this sort of medieval polyphonic composition. So you have a pre-existing melody and then other voices sing on top of it. And so I was thinking about that, of sort of finding other beats inside of this beat and this sort of nesting of voices and nesting of music, one inside of the other.
That's cool. That's a great start. Julia, do we have polyphony in the poem itself, or is it only referring to polyphony?
I think there is a lot of polyphony. It is thy, it is thee, it is I, it is me in the second stanza, and then going back to that first stanza, when she says you may find other beats, I mean a beat, we're already getting sort of like one inside the many. We're getting, you know, both an I and some other pronoun. There's a you, so lots of different voices.
Steve, can you translate for, you know, a rookie? Let's just say I'm a rookie here. What would beat, what are some synonyms for beat there? There must be several.
You know, of course, it could be capital beat, the beat poets, but I think for Joanne, I think that it's more the music and the rhythms. Mm-hmm. And I had the chance to talk with her about this poem when I told
her
I was coming here. Yeah.
Tell us one thing she said about this.
Well, I know she said several times, and I spoke with her a couple times about it, but she said that it was really, you know, the poem is mostly a sort of exploration of this rhythm and music of putting this stuff together. So I think the beat has to do with, like, the beat. You can hear it in her voice. I mean, it's like it's a fluid meter.
Julia, is it fair of me to call this voice, it's a mid-70s voice performing a poem written earlier, so is it fair or unfair of me to hear a countercultural voice, including tone?
I would say yes.
Kind of a loaded question, but...
I would say it's quite fair, but there's also a lot of ambiguity, especially when she gets to the machines.
Mm-hmm.
When she says, machines are metal, they serve us, we take care of them. That's kind of a pessimistic view of the rise of the machine, certainly in American culture, but then it becomes kind of tender.
Yeah, I wanted to say one thing about that. I believe that Joanne said to me, oh, that was Creeley. He was always talking about the machines. So,
in a bad or good sense?
Probably in a bad sense. Yeah. You know, that, I mean, this is out in Bolinas where, you know, we're not in the machine or age exactly.
Far.
You
we got away from the machine.
We have that in the Berrigan poem, A House in the Country.
So we have a kind of contradiction, I would try to stipulate. The countercultural 60s, 70s left is not going to be beloved of the machine. In fact, the machine... Someone at Berkeley in the early 60s would describe the machine as the thing they want to break apart in order to create the free speech movement. But in the 30s, the old left and the modernists of the 20s and 30s, they love the machine.
Right.
And Creeley kind of, in a way, descends from the kind of Williams who liked the typewriter and who liked gears. So she's exploring a contradiction in what poets would do to embrace or run away from the machine.
And Williams says, of course, a poem is a small machine, small or large machine made out of words.
Right.
And that's a more or less romanticized view back in the 40s. But I think there's also a little bit of, it's almost ominous even when Williams says it. There's almost a fear of the rise of the machine.
You know, there's also the sense maybe that the machines, this machine is the typewriter.
They serve the line, us.
They
we
serve
type
us.
Poems on them.
We take care of them. They serve us. This is to me and this is to you. And
the idea that she made enough poetry to keep her company.
She stamped out enough
poems.
So it's kind of the writing of this poem, as soft as it is in the way it's performed and written, sweet little tone, is produced by a machine. It's an industrial process. Patty, your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, that's what I thought. By the time I got to the end of that stanza with that she made enough poetry to keep her company, you know, I thought that that is the inevitable production, right, of these, the machines or metal they serve us, that the production we arrive at is the production of poems then, in that stanza anyway.
During the beat of this story, you may find many other beats. I mean a beat. I mean cantus. I mean firmus. I mean paper. I mean in the kingdom, which is coming, which is here in discovery. It is also Om Shri Maitreya. You don't go across my vibes, but with them, losing the pronoun. It is thy, it is thee, it is I, it is me. Machines are metal. They serve us. We take care of them. This is to me, and this is to you. You say you to me, and I say you to you. Some machines are very delicate. They are precise. They are not big metal stampers. She made enough poetry to keep her company.
So how do we get from, we think the title is, It's Been a Long Time. That's at least the title she gives it in the selected poems. But the way she reads it, it sounds like the title is Notes from a Revolution, but it might be the first line. It's all caps.
Well, the way it looks on the page, it looks as though this is a kind of reverse epigraph or something. It's been a long time.
It's been a long time. Looks like an epigraph.
Notes of the Revolution is from the Revolution, bold-faced and centered.
So my question is, insofar as Notes from the Revolution is an important introductory phrase, how do we get from the Revolution to this writing? Is the art, is this an instance of a revolution? Who wants to try that one? Patty, any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I was thinking about it in relationship to that first line, which I was reading as a first line that sort of happens outside of the poem, It's Been a Long Time, and that Notes from the Revolution, what does that mean, that the poem has been coming for a long time, or that the revolution, to sort of reflecting upon it, and the idea to take note of something and to also to record it and want to have some kind of record of this revolution.
So you've given
but then,
us,
of course,
I think,
notes with beats and, you know, so I think that the title moved around in the poem in a lot of different ways.
So you gave us four connotations,
right,
for notes.
Sorry,
one is, no, one, one is a kind of proposal, as in, right, Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction, you know, some the beginnings of a program. The second one was notes, some jottings, because we need to archive this moment.
Mm-hmm.
The third was notes, as in beats.
Right.
I can't remember what the fourth one was. So can you draw this together with, I mean, revolution in the political sense at all?
Well, there's also revolution of the machine. Machines literally revolve, and they have gears that shift and click and whir and move around.
Yeah.
And when she writes during the beat of this story to me means both the revolution and this poem. During the beat of this poem, you may find other beats within this poem that I am writing, but in which there is this machine, this shifting voice, there's polyphony, there are multiple voices and multiple subjects.
What's radical about that?
Many things are radical about it, including the idea that the poem is composed by more than one person. It's composed, it's co-composed by a machine and a person or persons, you know?
Not to mention thy, thee, I, me, which are all forms of third and first person.
That's right.
But four different. What's radical about it, Steve?
Well, I think the revolution is also, this is 1971 or two. That's the date she gave it to both. So, you know, let's take her word for that. Read later on,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
Well, it's already in the past. But so that the revolution and was in the air. Bolinas was a place people went to drop out. They could. It was cheap. It was inexpensive. You could afford to.
Thus, Creeley on his back looking at the sky.
Yeah. Clark Coolidge.
What?
I mean, the Bill Berkson.
Did you drop in on that scene at all?
73.
And what was it? Are we right about this, that scene? Are you describing it well?
Yeah.
For yourself?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's something she spoke about in conversations, that this was. I said, well, what the revolution? She said, well, revolution was in the air, but I think, in some sense, this poem is in revolt against what was elsewhere going on, and not, you know, that puts it, that makes use of the word revolution, but it's an enactment of counterculture going on here.
Patty, help us with vibes. Uh-huh. So vibes has a certain connotation from that period. an overused word from that period, as I recall. But there's a lot going on with vibes. Can you talk about that?
Right. Yeah. You know, when I was reading it, I was thinking about it as the word vibes, almost as a sort of time machine that was happening to me in this poem. I was, you know, sort of transported to the 70s. But thinking about it in a really, you know, sort of literal or dictionary definition sense of the way that one's emotions can be understood by somebody else, or the way that people emotionally can communicate to each other. So I was thinking about it in that way, as a type of communication.
Who would you be in You Intercepted My Vibes?
I don't know, because later it's, you say you to me, I say you to you, right? The you is the other person, right? Whoever it is who's speaking, the you is always the other person.
Mm-hmm. Steve, You Intercepted My Vibes?
Yeah, I have a word from the source on that. She said,
"Oh, good."
Yeah, hey. She said,
"It's almost as if Joanne is here."
It appears twice in the poem and in different instances. One after the Om Shri Maitreya, "You don't go across my vibes," and then quite further down, "My vibes, you intercepted my vibes." And she kind of read it in this
voice. It's a negative thing, isn't it?
She said, "Oh, that was the Doss boys, John and Margot Doss, who had, John Doss was a, I mean, they were involved. They were, they moved to Belize, had a poetry kind of community around them. Margot Doss used to write a column for the San Francisco Chronicle called The Bay Area at My Feet. It was like walking tours. But they had these boys who are now grown men, she laughed with that same laugh as on the tape, said, "Oh, that was the Doss boys that said that," probably echoing their parents or the adults they heard using the word vibes. You know, they were, I don't know how old they were, maybe they were 6, 7, 8 years old.
Om Shri Maitreya, what is it? Anybody know?
Oh, it's the hymn of the Buddha, isn't it?
The hymn of the Buddha. And does it have us, other than its Buddhistic references, does it have a specific literary, political, or poetic, historical reference?
Ginsberg and Snyder, Gary Snyder.
Mm-hmm. Repeatedly chanted this. They did it in Czechoslovakia at a very critical moment.
Good for you.
Good for Google. Anyway, because they weren't speaking Czech, and they were part of the spring that got shut down. Oh. That would be 68, I think.
Yeah.
And they repeated that again and again and again. And then the same thing happened in The Summer of Love, and the same two of them, Ginsberg and Snyder. So why, let's just put that out there, Wikipedia-like. Does that help us at all understand why she is using it?
For Ginsberg and Snyder, wasn't it also about kind of invoking a new future, or it's a future looking use of the phrase specifically? So if this poem is also thinking about the future, that's another meaning of the word revolution here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want a better future, or presumably we want a different future that's beyond the current culture, beyond the current machine.
You know, and I think that's right on the mark. In context of this book, All This Every Day, the first poem makes reference to Lord Ganesha, the scorpion guru, Pulahari, Vajrapranya. I mean, the book begins with many references to all that. And Joanne pencils in the margin of this copy next to Om Shri Maitreya, "Maitreya, the coming Buddha." So
a reference to the future in the context of revolution, possibly a reference to colleagues and friends who use this phrase in order to say, "We're with you, we will go together into the future." So here it is. It is also Om Shri Maitreya, "You don't go across my vibes, but with them," losing the pronoun.
Well, that comes right after, "I mean, in the kingdom, which is coming." So there's this kingdom that's coming, which is here in discovery. Guess what? The kingdom's actually already here, which is a kind of Buddhist way of looking at things, or at least the be poet version of Buddhist. So if we're thinking about the future, I think we're also thinking about the future that's already here, which is in some ways being invoked with the use of
And that would be the revolution then.
That's the revolution is already happening.
Yeah.
My vibes. You interrupted my vibes. The long shadows, the long shadows, the long shadows. My sweet little tone, my sweet little tone is my arm. On what only? The song that girls sing, the song that girls sing.
Patty, can you help with the sweet little tone, my sweet little tone? Whenever I see a powerful poet like Joanne Kiger refer to possibly herself, the tone in her own arm, the writing arm maybe, I assume it's a Dickinsonian irony. When Emily Dickinson talks about herself as narrow and little, watch out because she's being big and explosive. Is that ironic, the sweet little one, or could it be a reference to someone else, not her? You want to take a stab?
Well, I mean, my sweet little tone, that repetition right above the song that girl sang, the song that girl sang, it's the exact same rhythm.
Yeah.
Both these five syllable phrases in the exact same rhythm. And
so that's the girl.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, talking about sort of losing the pronoun and these kind of exchanges of pronouns that seem to happen in the poem, how we move from thy and I and you to she, and then now at the end, you know, that girl. So my sweet little tone, the song that girl sang, there's just all that exchange of music and sound.
Julia, let me ask you, we heard the little anecdote. She begins spontaneously, I think, in the performance we heard from Public Access Poetry, referring to when Creeley was visiting Bolinas and how we would look at the clouds, and Creeley kept saying, look, there's a castle up there. Can you connect that anecdote to this poem? Why did she tell that story, do you think?
My interpretive guess is that she's remembering Creeley, so she's remembering a part of an important figure in her poetic, you know, sphere, her circle, her poetic circle, and the way that Creeley saw that castle up there in the sky, which to me connects to this kingdom and this future that's already here in the poem.
Nice. Heavenly.
Yeah. And to see that the possibility is already here, but it's only here when we sit together and we talk together in the way that I think people are talking together in this poem.
Right.
Seems to me to be the thing that connects Kiger and Creeley.
You know, I think that's absolutely right, except I would change the tense, because Creeley lived there. He didn't just visit, and it was in the present, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
This is when Bob Creeley was around, and he used to say, look up in the sky. So, and I think these people are all talking, and somehow I think this poem is like a montage, collage of actual lived, you know, probably very recent, immediate kinds of experiences.
And it's so interesting to me then, if the notes and the citations are kind of submerged for those of us who might not get all the references, they're still there. Like, we still get that sense of
really intricate
connection.
Yeah, that's why to me it was so interesting to talk with her, and it gave me a real insight into how she makes these poems. You know, it's really made up of a lot of concrete material that's coming in. And one thing I noticed, you know, this poem's kind of unusual for Joanne in that it's so much on the left margin, and so much of her work is, you know, off the left margin, and being off the left margin is what she talks about a lot. And so this is almost like...
Seems like prose poetry, and it seems like notes, paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we could talk about this poem for a long time. What I'd like to do is invite each of you to say one last thing, something that you wanted to get on the record here about this poem or about Kiger in this poem. And so why don't we start with Julia?
I just have been wanting to say that I really love the way in the last two stanzas the poem becomes really, really, really song-like. You know, my vibes, you intercepted my vibes, the long shadows, the long shadows, the long shadows. It becomes incantatory in this really, really amazing way. And there's something you realize in hearing Joanne read it that you don't necessarily see on the page right away.
Great. Thank you. Patty, final thought?
Well, my final thoughts are actually on the end of the poem as well, and how that sort of the emotional communication, if you were, of vibes, for me, comes connected back to the beat of the first stanza and her wordplay with cantus firmus and all of these voices. And as Julia said, the incantatory effect of the long shadows, and the song that girl sang, the song that girl sang. And that, for me, really connects us back to the first stanza of the poem.
Very nice. Thank you.
Yeah, that's
Steve.
Great. I'd like to take a stab at that same kind of material, going from It's been a long time looking way back into the past, you know, maybe thousands of years in poetry. Then the cantus, this song, you know, the cantus firmus, firmus, the paper, which again, Joanne mentioned Creeley in those lines. Maybe he talked about the cantus all the time, and, you know, it's Creeley's interest in song, Campion, yeah, et cetera. But going to the end, vibes is again sound and tone, and then the beautiful, the long shadows. It's this like incantatory repetition of present tense, mm-hmm, perception of these things. Then my sweet little tone, and there's a line break, and again that sound, and then my sweet little tone is my arm. She mentioned that tone arm comes out of Ron Padgett, and then but she also said Bill Berkson, who lived in Bolinas End, was always talking about his tone arm on his record player. Mm-hmm. I noticed he had, yeah, an amazing, yeah, record collection. He was always playing.
Yeah, so that the tone makes sense.
And then finally, the song that girl sang could be like Joanne looking from the future back at herself, being the girl singing these songs. It's, yeah, a very beautiful ending.
Yeah. Well, I have just two quick thoughts. One that follows from what Steve just said. When I read the song that girl sang, and then I think about finding other beats, I begin to see beats as partly about beats, as in beat poets, mm-hmm, beat movement. And I think of Joanne Kiger as using this poem partly to carve out a different sound, a different space, a different beat. And if you follow the beat of this story, you might find other beats, mm-hmm, other kind of beat poetry. The song that girl sang, as opposed to the song those guys sang.
Yeah.
Maybe you could,
yes,
say that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I really think she's finding other beats. And I think in
That's
this
great.
Song we find other beats.
That's great.
And the second point I'd like to make is that I like this phrase Steve's been using, which I think you're partly channeling your conversations with Joanne Kiger, the poet herself, in the phrase revolution in the air. it was actually a line, you know, Dylan used later when he was recalling the same scene in New York. There was revolution in the air.
Yeah.
Now, I like to think of this poem combining with the recollection of Creeley looking at the air and finding the long shadows, the long shadows, mm-hmm, the long shadows of the clouds, and helping us all discover what a poetics would be if it was in the air. It's kind of an airy revolutionary poetics because revolution's in the air. So anyway,
nice.
That was a little...
Pretty
a little
nice.
Tricky, but I stand by my
Very
first
nice.
Point. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world who wants to gather some paradise. And I see you have a Women of the Beat Generation anthology, Julia Block. Wow. Does that follow from my last comment?
Well, I brought it because I wanted to talk about it today, and then it follows perfectly from what you just said about finding other beats. So this anthology actually came out in 96, but I recently rediscovered it and have been reading through it, and it's edited by Brenda Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. It's called Women of the Beat Generation, The Writers, Artists, and Muses at the Heart of a Revolution. It's a terrific anthology. Joanne Kiger's in it, along with Ann Waldman, even folks like Barbara Guest, whom Brenda counts among some of the precursors to women of the Beat Generation. It's got a really amazing bibliography at the end, and I highly, highly recommend it.
Great. Thank you so much, Patty McCarthy.
Reading this poem from the earlier mid-70s, I was thinking about I'm currently reading Sasha Steenson's new book of poems, The House of Deer, which is in part drawn from her childhood spent in the Back to the Land movement and then sort of homesteading and all great things of the 70s. So I wanted to say something about that. It's a really great new book.
Great. Thank you, Patty. Steve?
I think we should read more of Joanne Kiger.
Great Gathering of Paradise.
Yeah, that would be really
Where would
a pleasure.
We start? Where would we start?
Well, the Penguin Anthology. I'm sure there are new... you know, she just went to Mexico and probably wrote... when she goes down there, it's in the winter... Sometimes in there was a book from Petsquaro a couple of years ago, little chapbook things. I don't know.
Great. Well, thanks for those great recommendations. Well, that's all the poetry to keep her company we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Julia Block, Patty McCarthy, and Stephen Radcliffe, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer today, Zach Cardiner, and to Poem Talk's editor, Allison Harris. Next time on Poem Talk, Leonard Schwartz, Jen McCreary, and Joe Malutis will join me to talk about Tom Leonard's performance of Shelley's The Revolt of Islam in Many Voices. Yes.
Whoa.
I can't wait for that. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again for that or another Poem Talk.